Welcome, everyone. Welcome back to the Strong Gravity Seminar Series. It's a pleasure to have Heike Hakobian with us today from Princeton to tell us about QED-mediated plasma processes in compact objects. Heike told me that he has a few sort of breaking points in the talk where he'll summarize some of what he's previously said. So those might be good sort of points to ask questions and sort of to save your questions for these spots. Okay, well, we look forward to your talk. Please take it from here, Heike.
Thank you for the introduction, Daniel, and thanks for the invitation and the opportunity to tell firsthand the amazing stuff we've been doing recently. So indeed, I'm going to talk about this plasma processes, which in certain compact objects are actually mediated by pretty extreme QED processes. And I'll break that down in a moment. And I'm going to particularly talk about the magnetic reconnection and briefly mention other microprocesses like turbulence that we're also interested in for the future. And that being said, Daniel said that I'll have a couple of breaking points, but feel free to stop me anytime you have questions. All right, so the outline of this talk is as follows. I'll just briefly talk about the phenomenology of compact objects and why do we care about kinetic physics happening there and why QED effects are sometimes important. I'll then talk about how we model these effects, both the kinetic plasma effects and mediated with QEDs. Then I'll briefly have this outline of magnetic reconnection in collisionless plasma. And one of the applications of this is actually the high energy emission of pulsars, of gamma ray pulsars. And I'll show you some simulations where this process is actually mediated by two-photon pair production, which is one of those QED processes we're interested in. And it turns out there are quite a lot of observational implications of this effect that we can actually deduce. And after that, I'll just quickly mention a couple of other systems where this processes might be very important, and we are very much interested in studying them in the future. Okay, so in compact objects, as you probably well know, the range of scales we're interested in, where the interesting physics, plasma physics happens, is ginormous. It goes from the Schwarzschild radii, which for M87, for instance, is a few hundreds of astronomical units, up to kiloparsecs if we're talking about jets. And for neutron stars, for instance, if we're talking about the neutron star itself, it's just a few tens of kilometers going all the way to the nebula for a few kiloparsecs. I apologize. The variability is also the observational characteristics of these objects is also very variable. So there are different kinds of short and long variability, for instance, in magnetars and also in X-ray binaries, which are the accreting black holes. And the spectra of observations is actually broad band. So this, for instance, I'm showing here on the right, the radiation from Blazar MKN421. The radiation of it goes all the way from radios to gamma rays. So the range of scales, the range of wave bands is enormous. And the models we're trying to build are actually need to explain all these kinds of variabilities, persistent emission in all these different scales. So typically what happens, this is a very schematic picture, but typically what happens in compact objects is we have some sort of the energy reservoir. It can be gravity, as in case of the black holes. It can be rotation, as in case of neutron stars. And somehow this energy is being converted to the energy of the magnetic field through different processes such as MRI, or in case of metacretion disc, it's being brought in by the accretion disc itself towards closer towards the black hole, and this process is being amplified, the magnetic field is being amplified. And typically we think about that these compact objects like black holes or neutron stars, as just conventionally illustrated here, are surrounded by these high magnetization, high magnetic field, strong magnetic field regions. It can be coronae of accretion disk, magnetospheres of neutron stars, even jets in some situations. And the characteristic parameter we usually like to talk about is this magnetization parameter, which is the ratio of the energy density in pointing flux or in magnetic field divided by the plasma rest mass energy density. And typically for these regions, this parameter is rather large. So MHD simulations actually are applicable to regions where this parameter is rather low. For example, for instance, MHD simulations are perfect for accretion disks. However, in situations where sigma is very large, there are extensions, for example, the force-free MHD, which is also a fluid model of MHD in the approximation where sigma is basically infinite, where plasma has no inertia. So the problem is, if we're trying to get from the energy stored in the magnetic field to the observed emission, we actually have to take a detour, because MHD simulations do not allow us to self-consistently, from first principles, reconstruct the observed emission because of the prescriptions that go into MHD. For instance, that the plasma is thermal. In one fluid MHD, electrons and ions are not are coupled. So these, to study, and also in ideal MHD, there is no resistivity which can break magnetic field lines and dissipate magnetic energy. So to study that consistently, we actually need kinetic simulations. And kinetic simulations will allow us to reconstruct from first principles these processes such as magnetic reconnection or turbulence that can actually tell you the rate and the amount of energy dissipated from magnetic fields deposited into particle kinetic energy and bulk motions of plasma, which can then radiate this this energy in the form of photons via your favorite radiation mechanism. Now, to complicate things even further, in some situations, which I'll be more interested in this talk, there is a feedback of this emitted radiation and this emitted radiation effects to the dissipation process itself, to plasma. The examples of this include, for example, the radiation drag, the simplest probably example. Photons can actually be coupled to plasma through Compton scattering, especially this might be important in optically thick regimes to Compton scattering. And actually you can have a lot of additional plasma loading in your system due to electron positron production, and the opposite of this, an electron positron annihilation. So the emitted radiation can go back into plasma and self-consistently be controlled by the amount of energy you deposit to radiation. And I'll talk about this and I'll give examples of this process in a minute. So we really, to understand this huge scale of observations, transient events and variability, and also the spectra, we actually need to model this energy transition self-consistently in kinetic plasma physics, including the radiation and all these QED effects. And now I'm going to talk about how we typically do this. Actually, not typically, because this is the first time people couple the kinetic physics and QED. So the classical kinetic approach is the so-called particle in cell algorithm, where you have charged particles that move continuously in the space, and they deposit currents and currents and charges on the grid. We have discretized electromagnetic fields that evolve according to Maxwell's equations. We couple these two with the Lorentz force. So the electromagnetic fields act on charged particles interpolated from the grid. Charged particles deposit currents, which are used in the Maxwell's equations. So this is the classical particle in cell algorithm that we use for kinetic plasma modeling. Now, we add to this the radiation drag force and photons, which are actual particles, which we trace in our simulations, which are self-consistently actually radiated by these charged particles. There can be the mechanisms are different. So there can be inverse Compton radiation from prescribed soft photon density. There can be synchrotron radiation, et cetera. And to this, we also add the QED processes, such as the coupling between charged particles and photons. Again, we track both of these species in our simulation. So this is something like a binary process on a grid. So we employ Compton scattering. Particles can actually collide with each other, leading to pair annihilation, and photons can collide, leading to additional pair production. So in a minute, I'm going to show you some results, including this two-photon pair production simulations that we've done before. So this is the point where I wanted to ask if you have any questions so far, but the main takeaways are that to reliably reconstruct the observed emission from these compact objects and the energy dissipation of the magnetic field, we actually have to use the kinetic plasma approach, at least to understand how this happens from first principles. And in some situations, which I'll show in a minute, radiative and QED effects can back react on this process. And they also have to be self-consistently included in the simulation. So the new frontier is this, I didn't come up with a better name, but this radiative QED pick approach that we're suggesting here. So I'll stop here and ask if people have any questions so far. Okay, it seems like, I don't see the chat, by the way. I do, okay. So next, I'll be talking about one of the examples of these kinetic plasma processes, which is the magnetic reconnection. I will also show the demonstration of this QED pick approach for modeling the high energy emission from pulsars. So magnetic reconnection, this will be a very brief overview of the state of the art understanding of what it looks like. So this process has been known for a lot of decades already, and primary source for that was the sun, where we observed the reconnection of magnetic field lines in these prominences or magnetic field loops. And we actually observed X-ray emission shown on the right from these regions, suggesting that these magnetic reconnection events can actually be accompanied by particle heating or acceleration in solar coronae. So what's happening, what the basic picture of what's happening is magnetic field lines of opposite polarities meet at some point, and because of the resistivity, because of the finite resistivity, the field lines are broken. The energy is being dissipated. It goes into particles, and particles then get energized and radiate emission that we see on the right. Now, in recent decade, it turned out that this reconnection is also interested not only in solar not only in solar context, but also in a range of different astrophysical systems. For instance, here on the left, I'm showing a resistive MHD simulate 2D resistive MHD simulation of the accretion disk done by Bart Ripperda, where he actually observes the current sheets, reconnection events. So the magnetic field direction here is shown with this conventional lines, arrows. And in the middle, you have this reconnection going on with the plasmoid formation. I'll talk about this plasmoids in a minute. And the same thing can be observed, for instance, in this force-free simulation of magnetar flares, where we basically launch a huge alphane wave from the surface of the star, from the surface of the magnetar, which opens up the whole magnetosphere, and poloidal field lines reconnect in the middle, producing this nice current sheet. The same is actually observed in kinetic simulations of kink unstable jets. So if you keep twisting the jet, at some point it becomes kink unstable. It starts to break up. And if you look closer, there are sources of reconnection in places where the magnetic field polarities magnetic fields of different polarities overlap. And what I'll be interested more in this particular talk, it will be the neutron star magnetospheres, where these kind of reconnection, and I'll show you in a minute a better movie of this. This kind of reconnection occurs in the outer magnetosphere. So this is the light cylinder, the so-called light cylinder. Everything inside is called the inner magnetosphere, or everything outside is the so-called outer magnetosphere. And the physics of this is that the plasma that fills the inner magnetosphere can actually co-rotate with the star. So you see the closed magnetic field lines with barely any toroidal field. So it's mostly poloidal field. But if you try to co-move, co-rotate with the star, with the neutron star outside this region, this light cylinder, you'll have to move faster than the speed of light. So that's the sort of the physics behind this inner and outer magnetosphere distinction. So at that point, you develop a toroidal magnetic field, which is shown here with these circles. And this toroidal magnetic field, the polarity of which is shown by the color, actually reconnects in the mid-plane, dissipating huge amount of energy in some pulsars. The strength of magnetic field here is mega gausses, 10 to the 6 gauss. And this energy can actually be deposited into pair plasma that flows from the inner magnetosphere, producing the observed radiation. But let's talk a little more about the reconnection first. So we typically study reconnection in this in the context of kinetic plasma physics in this localized boxes, where instead of focusing on the whole system, instead of focusing for on the whole accretion disk, we actually focus on a small current sheet. A current sheet which is supported by curl B, basically. This is the so-called Harris configuration. So we have plasma in the background, and we have dense plasma in the middle, which is actually counterflowing. So this is pair plasma, it's counterflowing, giving us a net current, which is supported by curl B. And this is an equilibrium condition. So curl B is balanced by J, B square is balanced by the pressure of the plasma in the mid plane. So this is a perfect kinetic equilibrium. And in all these systems I'm going to talk about, the magnetic energy density is actually far exceeds the plasma rest mass energy density. So here I'm going to show a movie, hopefully it will play well, but of what the plasma, the evolution of plasma density and magnetic field lines look like in a typical kinetic magnetic reconnection. So remember, we have plasma at the background, the magnetic field is pointing to the right at the top here and to the left at the bottom. And if we launch the simulation, so what happens is this equilibrium is very unstable. So because of the noise, it breaks. So this current sheet starts to break. And the magnetic field lines, because of the resistivity we have in our simulation, which is actually not explicit, it's actually self-consistent kinetic resistivity. And it starts to break. The magnetic field is dissipated and particles inflow with an E cross B velocity to the current sheet, and they escape to these structures called plasmoids. So yeah, this is to just demonstrate what's happening in terms of bulk motions. So the inflow velocity is typically, in kinetic simulations, is typically 0.1 C. That's basically our E cross B velocity. The outflow velocity, which is the velocity inside the current sheet, along the current sheet, is basically controlled by the Alvain speed. And in relativistic simulations, it's more or less the speed of light. So because we dissipate magnetic energy, we actually generate resistive electric field. And in this jargon of kinetic plasma kinetic reconnection, these are called the X points, the place where the magnetic field goes through zero and there is the electric field is large. And in this case, it's actually pointing inwards in the in plane. And you form these so-called O points or plasmoids or magnetic islands, call it whatever, where the recycled plasma, the energized plasma, ends up being accumulated in this kind of simulation. And just a reminder, the magnetization here is huge. So the available magnetic energy per plasma rest mass energy is huge. So the this process is inherently relativistic. Now, in terms of particles, let's see what this looks like. So particles shown here with dots, and you can actually show them grow in size and change in color as they get energized. So they're being carried with an E cross B velocity towards the current sheet. They get energized, as you see, they're getting orange and red. They get energized in these X points where there is huge electric field and almost no magnetic field. And they end up accumulating in these plasmoids. And this is what the spectrum, evolution of the spectrum looks like. It quickly develops a power law. So it quickly develops a power law up to a certain maximum energy. So let's talk about that for a moment. The power law typically varies from -1 to -2, -3, depending on how large, how relativistic the simulation is. The maximum energy is typically controlled also by the sigma parameter, by the magnetization. So the maximum energy to which you accelerate particles is typically sigma times mc squared times phi. And there are actually two acceleration channels which we discovered recently. One of them was the well-known something studied a few years ago, this primary fast magnetization of fast acceleration, which happens in X points because of these parallel electric field present in the current sheet. And the second one actually happens after particles are being accelerated here. So it's a sort of a two-step process. And that happens inside the plasmoids as plasmoids get contracted. And this is one of our recent discoveries. As plasmoids get contracted, the insides of them get contracted, you actually get the secondary process, which is way slower. But in the meantime, it's not limited to the sigma parameter. So you might think this is very important in observations because in a lot of situations, sigma is actually, for example, in jets, sigma is actually pretty mild. Sigma is 10. And if you want to produce particles with gamma factors of thousands, Lorentz factors of thousands, you're going to have a hard time doing this with you're going to have a hard time doing this with primary X point acceleration. But in the meantime, it seems like these plasmoids can accelerate particles indefinitely, and particles can, of course, happily shine their favorite synchrotron emission while being trapped in these plasmoids. Okay, so now I'm going to spend most of the talk talking about the magnetic reconnection in neutron stars, and especially talking about the QED effects that are present in these neutron stars and how they modify the process of reconnection I just described. So in this sort of cartoon, well, it's actually not a cartoon, it's one of our simulations, 3D, three-dimensional simulations, you actually see the neutron star. Of course, it's not to scale. So the neutron star here typically is 10 kilometers. The light cylinder, which is this point, at which point, as I said, the plasma stops co-rotating and you start developing toroidal field lines. This is a few thousands of kilometers. So the scale separation in reality here is order of hundreds. We can't afford that in 3D simulations. But if we're interested primarily in what happens in the outer magnetosphere, that's fine. So we can allow ourselves to sort of rescale these sizes to properly be able to model. And you can actually see that the field lines from the northern and southern hemispheres of the neutron star overlap in the middle, and they reconnect, forming this current sheet. And instead of seeing plasmoids as just circles like you've seen here, in this case, in 3D, you actually see these elongated tubes, which are just the analogies of plasmoids in 3D. And this whole there is a lot of things going on here. Because, for example, this whole current sheet is actually being torn by kink instability. So I'm not going to stop there. But what we think is happening, basically, the magnetic field is being dissipated in the outer magnetosphere, so beyond the light cylinder, due to reconnection. And that energy is deposited into particles, which then shine synchrotron photons. Just a reminder, the fields vary from thousands to 10 to the 6 Gausses for these objects at the light cylinder. And that's what we think is producing the observed pulsed gamma ray emission from pulsars, which is actually observed by Fermi. So this is an example of what we think, schematic example of what we think is happening. So this is an observational light curve of gamma ray observed by Fermi, and this is the typical spectrum that we observe from them. It cuts down somewhere around a few GeVs for most of the pulsars. It has a characteristic power loss slope. And this is from simulations by Benoit, Chiruti, and Sasha Filipov and others. So here you see that the light curve is basically formed by the beaming effect. So as the sort of current sheet in this tilted case points at us, we see the radiation, so the synchrotron radiation coming at us. So we see this maxima, and if it's pointing in the opposite direction, we see minima. And actually, this is supported by the lag that we see of gamma rays compared to radio, because in radio, we think radio emission is generated somehow in the inner magnetosphere, so somewhere closer to the star. So it comes a little later than the radiation generated in the upper magnetosphere. And this is one of the spectra the simulations develop. The problem with this model comes when we try to extrapolate this to the population of gamma ray pulsars. If we actually try to do that, so you remember that the maximum energy to which reconnection can accelerate is controlled by this sigma parameter, by the magnetization parameter. And for pulsars, we can actually roughly estimate the scaling of it, at least. It's basically the B square, the pointing flux energy divided by plasma rest mass energy. And plasma rest mass energy in pulsar scales as a so-called Goldreich-Julien density, so it's proportional to B. So the cutoff energy, the cutoff Lorentz vector, has to be proportional to the magnetic field that the light cylinder linearly. At the same time, you can do this argument for synchrotron emission. So the cutoff frequency for synchrotron emission is basically the gamma squared times B. And that should scale as B to the cube. Now, the problem is that we don't actually, if we observe the actual gamma ray pulsars, we can plot their light cylinder magnetic field for the whole population. And as I said, it varies from thousands to 10 to the 6 Gauss. But the cutoff energy surprisingly varies only mildly in this, in for all these pulsars. So it's around few GeVs for most of them. And even more complicated, puzzling is the fact that for the youngest pulsars, so for pulsars with largest E dot, largest spin down rate, which we can measure actually with a pretty good accuracy for pulsars from radio observations. So the emitted pointing flux, the less of the emitted pointing flux is converted into radiation for these pulsars. So this is a puzzling, it is the case for the lower energy, for instance, this millisecond pulsars, which are shown with the red here. So L gamma roughly is proportional to some fraction of E dot, typically it's 10%. But for these higher energy pulsars, this higher E dot pulsars, that doesn't turn out to be the case. So something has to be different for these pulsars. And the solution we think might be applicable in this case is this radiative and QED effects I mentioned before. So first of all, this strong synchrotron drag, because the if you estimate the timescale for acceleration, this is the power of acceleration. And I'm probably missing a factor of C here, but it doesn't matter. So the timescale of acceleration is actually way slower than the timescale for synchrotron cooling for typical particles with gamma factors of around sigma or less. So that's one thing. Actually, we think that this synchrotron drag cannot decrease the acceleration, because the acceleration, if you remember, happens in the place where the magnetic field vanishes, basically. So the synchrotron drag force there is essentially zero. So particles get accelerated without any barriers, and then they quickly radiate as they enter to the plasmoids. And I'll show you a simulation in a minute. But also, most importantly, is the second effect. The two photon pair production. So if you looked at the spectra here, actually there are a lot of photons of energies MAV and beyond. So these photons can actually interact and produce secondary pairs. And what happens then is that if you produce secondary pairs, the sigma parameter, which if you remember was the ratio between the magnetic energy density to plasma density, so the plasma energy density grows. And because of that, the efficiency of your reconnection may drop, because reconnection is controlled by this sigma parameter. And even though the optical depth for this process is tiny for most of the pulsars, for Crab it's somewhere of the order of 0.1 or 0.01, actually there are so many photons that they can produce thousands, or even if I remember correctly, tenth of thousand times more plasma from this process than you could otherwise afford from the inner magnetosphere. So for every particle you put in, you get 10,000 times more particles produced via this process. And we can actually model this not in 3D for now, but in 2D simulation. So this is just a cut in this reconnecting current sheet. And you can actually see what's going on here. I bet the movie is a bit junky, so I'll just pause it here. So here we'll see the total density of plasma, of both the initial plasma that is inflown from the upstream and the plasma produced in situ by this two-photon pair production. And the particle spectrums are actually more or less unaffected by this process. You still form the nice power law with a nice cutoff near sigma, near a few sigma. Now, this is the photons. On the bottom plot, we show the photons, which, as I said, we actually track in our simulation self-consistently. So they're just emitted as regular particles from our tracked charged particles. So these are the synchrotron photons, and this is the spectra, which corresponds very well with the observations. And actually what's more interesting here is this multiplicity parameter, which is the ratio of the produced plasma to the initial plasma. And if you see here the scale, in some regions, it reaches thousands in this simulation. So in green to in yellow to white regions, it actually exceeds thousands. So for every particle you put in, you produce 1,000 times more secondary particles. So in other words, most of what you see here, most of the density you see on this plot is actually produced inside the sheet self-consistently by photons. And because of that, actually, so this is just to clarify that point about the efficiency of reconnection. So we have this effective reconnection now, which is controlled not only by the plasma that is inflown from the inner magnetosphere, but also from the plasma, by the plasma that is produced in situ by this two-photon pair production. And if this is large, the sigma can actually drop drastically. And what this means for pulsars is the efficiency of reconnection, the maximum energy to which reconnection can accelerate particles drops drastically for these systems. And the cutoff energy thus does not scale as rapidly with the magnetic field. So this is basically shown here with the schematics. This is a very beautiful self-controlled loop where the more you accelerate particles in the current sheet, so the higher the sigma, in other words, the more you produce these synchrotron photons. And the more you produce the synchrotron photons, the more you produce pairs which rain down and decrease sigma, and you start to produce less of these synchrotron photons. So it's sort of like an inverse, the inverse feedback loop, which self-controls itself towards some sort of equilibrium. This is just a glance of what this might look like in 3D. This is our recent unpublished simulations. So these are the secondary plasma produced in the current sheet. The movie is probably, again, junky, so I'll stop it. So this is the current sheet view as shown from the edge of the pulsar. And these are this additional extra plasma, which are produced from the photons, which are actually shown here with this huge three-dimensional cloud. The cloud is mostly, of course, focused towards the current sheet. And the important, this is just to recap this important sort of observational implications of this. So for most of the young pulsars, so this one is the crab. This is the PP dot diagram. So the breaking, so the amount of this is the amount the pulsar spins down. This is its period. These are the millisecond pulsars with periods of few to tens milliseconds. These are regular pulsars, and the green ones, if you see the color here, the green ones are the youngest and the most energetic ones. And for them, actually, the amount of plasma you produce is actually thousands or tens of thousands times more than the amount you have from the inner magnetosphere. And this actually controls the cutoff energy, as I've made a point in my last slide. So also the gamma ray luminosity is suppressed for these pulsars. So that's kind of self-consistently explains all these different observational features. There is another one actually, which I'll briefly mention, is there is this anomalously high flux of pairs. Well, of course, it's observed from the radiation of them, but there is an anomalous population of pairs in the nebula and Crab Nebula, which we observed, and it's far more than we can produce inside the pulsar. So there has to be some other source for pair production, at least in Crab pulsar, and this mechanism sort of suggests a very viable scenario where this can be self-consistently produced. And then, as you've seen in this movie, it then escapes, these pairs then escape to the nebula with the bulk flow. Okay, so I'm gonna wrap up with the main part, and I've only got left a couple of slides here. So it seems like the reconnection is actually very powerful mechanisms for very powerful and actually fast mechanism for magnetic energy dissipation and particle acceleration. We think that it produces the gamma ray emission from pulsars, and we think that this process is actually mediated by this two photon pair production and strong synchrotron drag. And in some situations, it not only impacts, but actually dominates this process, especially for some young pulsars.
I think this is maybe a good point. I guess I missed the key point. So you said this pair production will change this parameter sigma. And how does the emission efficiency depend on this sigma?
Emission efficiency, sorry?
Yeah, the efficiency.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's not really the emission efficiency, it's the efficiency of the reconnection itself. So if you remember from this plot, the reconnection can actually accelerate particles up to just few of these sigmas. So up to the few times the sigma mc square. So the maximum energy of particles, of typical particles you get in the magnetic reconnection, is few times sigma. The secondary process is basically killed because of the synchrotron cooling in pulsars. So you can forget about this second branch. So, but this primary fast acceleration can only accelerate particles up to a few sigma. And if the sigma drops, you can afford accelerate up to the few sigma effective, and the sigma effective is dropped. So okay. That's the whole idea.
Okay. So why does this F gamma is inverse proportional to gamma square? So what is the physics behind it?
Which one?
Sorry. So you probably just showed me, right? Like gamma to the minus two,
Why is this minus two?
Yeah.
That's a good point, and we don't actually know. There are theories. So there are kinetic. You can write some simple kinetic arguments. When particle gets too energized, it actually gets deflected from this current sheet. So you can write very simple kinetic equations with an escape term, depending on particle gamma factor, and you can obtain some sort of power laws. But a better answer would be we don't know why reconnection forms a power law in the first place. So that's kind of a fair answer, I think. But the part that we can accelerate only up to few sigma can actually be derived from very simple arguments, and actually this is determined by the size of the current sheet, the characteristic size of the current sheet, and the Larmor radius of particles in this current sheet. So if particle has a Lorentz vector of sigma, the Larmor radius is actually larger than the characteristic size of the current sheet. So the particle just won't be bound to the current sheet and it will escape.
Okay.
So in other words, this is pretty solid. This we're not sure, but I mean, kinetic simulations sort of converge that indeed we produce power laws.
Okay, sorry, one last question. So let's say you have this particle spectrum, and then you try to compute mm-hmm. your gamma ray emission from it. What is the main mm-hmm. emission mechanism
from this? Oh, particle? Yeah, that's a good point. This is purely synchrotron emission.
Synchrotron, okay.
Yes, yeah. And the complicated part is you cannot do this in post-processing. So in other words, you cannot just take this spectrum and produce this spectrum just by assuming the magnetic field is uniform, because actually particles get accelerated in one place and radiated in another place. So you have to do this self-consistently. That's sort of the most exciting and also most complicating part of this.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, so
this is Daniel again. Can I also sure. quickly ask a question before you
of course,
move on?
Yeah.
So I was wondering, so I find that secondary plasma process generation very intriguing. And so do you understand physically what actually saturates that secondary plasma formation? So what sort of defines the saturation point of that plasma generation?
Yeah, that's a good point. This comes to the schematics I've shown. Basically, the secondary plasma density depends on the average density of photons above some energy, so above, say, MeV. And that is actually controlled by how much you accelerate particles, because if you accelerate to less energies, in the same magnetic field, they will radiate less of the high energy particles. So the amount you put in radiation will be the same, but the sort of whole spectrum of the radiation will be shifted to the left of the spectrum. So you'll produce less of the MeV photons, and this MeV photon and the less MeV photons you produce, the less secondary particles you'll have. And the less you'll affect the sort of the reconnection, the efficiency of reconnection. So imagine the system, imagine if you artificially pump sigma up. So what happens is you accelerate particles to higher energies. You produce more high energy photons, you produce more secondary pairs, and that sort of back reacts and decreases sigma. So it's like it's like a negative heat capacity equilibrium.
Right. Okay, and so the other thing I was wondering, like observationally, so mm-hmm. probably in most cases you're in this fast cooling synchrotron cooling regime, so you don't really see the photons. But could there be observationally any scenarios in which you could actually sort of from observing the photon spectrum infer how much secondary plasma there is, just based on the photon spectrum?
It's very challenging, especially for pulsars, mainly because we don't actually know what the density produced in the inner magnetosphere is in the first place. So we can theorize there are maximum bounds we can put. So we can say that the potential drop across the polar cap, across the neutron star surface, allows us to produce this many pairs and not more. So that we can solidly put a limit on, but we can't say how much less it actually is from that maximum limit. So we can say that it, when it's anomalously high, so when the amount of flux we observe in radiation is anomalously high, but we can't say how much of that is actually from secondary pairs because we just don't know what was the... So it's kind of challenging for that. In some situations, you actually can. For example, in accretion disk, which I hope to talk in a moment, you actually can do arguments like that. But in this case, no, not in pulsars.
Okay, thanks.
So if there are no questions, we can remain connected after the talk, so you can ask questions left. But I wanted to briefly sort of outline some of the future prospects where this QED effects might be important, coupled with kinetics. And one of them is actually the X-ray binaries. So in X-ray binaries, we observe this dichotomy of states. Where there is a hard state and there is soft state, and it's observed in a wide range of different X-ray binaries. And we think that the hard state, which is shown here with this hard power law, is produced from the inverse Compton emission of hot corona from scattering of soaked photons from the disk. To go more into details of observations, we actually do observe a lot of millisecond duration flares during that hard state, during which the luminosity grows by a factor of a few. And the time scale millisecond actually is pretty fast, because that suggests there is some violent processes happening on Schwarzschild time scales, scales of Schwarzschild radius. And this is an open issue, because we don't understand how actually the corona is being formed, how is it being populated, how is it being energized, because MHD simulations have a hard time reproducing this corona because of the very high sigma, very high magnetization, and low plasma beta. And one of the theories that actually comes from the solar physics. On the sun, we have these magnetic loops, which are generated by the dynamo action in the sun and are convectionally pushed outwards from the surface to the surface of the sun. In accretion disk, you can actually think of something very similar, where there is a dynamo because of the shear of the accretion disk, and these loops are formed and they're being buoyantly pushed upwards. And this is what kind of, we think, populates corona. And then these loops can either reconnect, as shown here on the right, because of the relative shear, or they can actually cascade due to this small reconnection events. They can actually cascade down the turbulence and produce turbulent, highly magnetized blob of corona atop this matter-dominated accretion disk. This is one of the cartoon simulations I've made recently with force-free MHD, where this is a sort of a demonstration of what the explosion of such a loop will look like. So this is ideal force-free, so all the energy dissipation is artificial, so it's numerical, but it kind of gives a sense of what the dynamics of this loop might look like. And basically what happens here, this loop is being sheared because of the Keplerian motion in the disk. So if it's slow enough, you accumulate very slowly the twist, and at some point this configuration becomes unstable. And it has to open up. When it opens up, the opposing field lines reconnect, producing this nice current sheet that you see here. And if you study this in kinetics, this may actually mean that this energy is being deposited into particles. So it's basically the heating of corona. Now, to complicate things even further again, in accretion disk Coronae, we think that the optical depth to this quantum process is, for instance, to pair production and Compton scattering are actually pretty large. And we can actually, this is the point where which we can prove observationally, because observationally we observe that the optical depth is order of unity, which is in a tense disagreement with the approximation that the corona is made from electrons and protons. So if you assume electrons and protons, you can actually show that the optical depths would be tiny. So you need some sort of electron positron plasma, and one of the mechanisms to produce it is the two photon pair production, and actually the annihilation might also take place because in this case the optical depth to this process is huge. And also, yeah, the inverse Compton radiation, while it's not important again for the acceleration, it might not be important because it's very slow on dynamical timescales. It actually might affect the bulk motions of plasma, so it might affect the the efficiency with which the energy is being distributed in the corona. So this will be a very, very nice problem to study in the future. There has been some very phenomenological work done, for example, in the papers I cite here, but no self-consistent global three-dimensional simulation of this process. Something very similar in terms of this loop happens in magnetars, might happen in magnetars. For instance, recently observed FRB from a galactic magnetar, which was accompanied by actually X-ray bursts. So there is this model, and this is the force-free simulations of that model, where the part of the magnetosphere is opened up because of the alphane wave, non-linear alphane wave that is launched from the surface of the magnetar. So that produces the FRB, but also you produce this secondary current sheet formed by because of the reconnection of poloidal field lines that can actually produce the observed X-ray bursts. And again, as was the case for the accretion disk, the optical depth to all these quantum processes is huge. So this will be accompanied by both pair production, Compton scattering, et cetera, which will control your optical depth, the amount of energy you put into these X-ray bursts, the variability, et cetera. And in this case, actually, the fields are way higher. So in accretion disks, I think the fields are 10 to the 6, 10 to the 8 Gauss. In this case, it's inner magnetosphere magnetar, so it's 10 to the 8, 10 to the 11 Gauss. So it's crazy high. And something very similar, and I'm not going to stop here at all, might be happening, and actually this is a very highly speculated thing because we have never observed this, but in coalescing neutron stars, binary neutron stars, shortly before they merge, their magnetospheres can actually overlap, forming this loop which connects the stars, and because of the twist of the rotation of the stars, this loop can actually get twisted, and as I've shown before, it can accumulate a twist and explode at some point, producing this FRB-like or maybe even high energy-like emission, which we can potentially observe shortly before the gravitational merger as a sort of a precursor, electromagnetic precursor emission. This is some unpublished preliminary particle in cell simulations without all these radiative effects. This is a force-free simulation of the same in 3D. And I'm not going to stop here at all, but I'm happy to talk that something very similar might happen in kink unstable or just on Kelvin Helmholtz or unstable jets. I'm not gonna spend any time here. So the main takeaways of this talk, I guess, are that the it seems like if you want to self-consistently study the magnetic energy dissipation in these compact objects and properly reproduce the particle acceleration, heating, and actually radiation, you have to do this in kinetic simulations because fluid simulations with the assumptions that go into them do not allow you to do that without any faking, sort of. In certain systems, these processes are largely mediated by QED processes, such as the radiation drag, the Compton scattering, and electron-positron production and annihilation. So you'll have to couple this with QED module numerically to model this self-consistently. And actually, in some we've seen an example where in some systems this QED process is not only influenced but also dominate this energy dissipation process, and you sort of have to, you're forced to include them to reproduce the observations and reproduce the overall dynamics properly. And I can elaborate a little more of what I mean influence and what can be actually studied in this regimes. What kind of effects do we expect to happen in this regimes, if you ask me. And I think this is all I wanted to tell. And I'll take questions at this point.
Thank you, Hike, for this beautiful talk. Do we have questions for Hike? It's been already quite some discussion during the talk, but sure there are more questions.
So Hike, I just had a quick question. So in the movie, which movie? Oh, which slides? Some slides back. Yeah, two movies. Yeah, so 35, slide 35.
35, yes, this one.
Yeah, what's going on there? So if I look at the left, there is a very clear structure, or maybe is it just me? So I see the light cylinder, and then I see some, yeah, that one. What is that?
Right, this is a good point. This is a very preliminary simulation, and this is not actually pair production, so I should have probably put that on the slide. This is, we try to understand, we don't do the pair production here properly, so we just inject plasma by hands in the upstream. And we do that starting from the light cylinder and beyond. So we're trying to understand just from, without including any physics for now, what additional plasma loading does to this global current sheet. Does it rip it off? Does it slow down the reconnection? Like in general, what happens? What happens to the pointing flux? So this is just for illustration purposes.
Okay, yeah. But you're if I get that right, because if I depends what where I'm looking at the left side or the right side of the movie, I see in the left it will look like you're injecting right at the light cylinder. In the right side, mm-hmm. it's a bit beyond the light cylinder, right? The X point or the Y point seems to be slightly. There's a slight gap.
Yeah, so the light cylinder is typically in this kinetic simulations, the light cylinder is typically, there are relativistic corrections to this. So it's typically a little bit inside of the C over omega.
Okay.
So it's not really strictly speaking C over omega. There are corrections to it because of the kinetics. But yeah, I mean, this is a good observation. So we inject at C over omega, which is the sort of analytical light cylinder. Yeah, this is just a cartoon. And actually it's a cartoon for us as well, just to understand what really is going on. This here on the right is actual photons. We still don't collide them. So we just produce to have a sense of where they get accumulated, how they escape. So these are actual photons, but these aren't the pairs produced from these photons.
All right, thank you.
But that's a good observation. Yeah.
So I wonder, give me just a quick glimpse of how you incorporate QED processes in the Boltzmann equation?
Right. So I did not talk about that because it's a pretty gory numerical details. But basically, so our particles are tracked in the same. So basically, what happens in PIC, you sample the distribution function, which in Boltzmann is just a continuous distribution function. In our case, you sample it with particles, with macro particles. So it's basically a way of sampling distribution function in both space and momentum space. So then these particles can actually interact, and this is very similar to processes people doing when they're trying to do Coulomb collisions in a particle in cell codes. So basically, it's a binary process. You have a cross section which defines the probability of your interaction. So the particles are just compared with each other depending on their momenta. You compute the probability, and according to that probability, you either interact or not. And this whole thing is of course works if these probabilities are small enough on a scale of the time step. But yeah, I mean, I can go into more details if you'd like, but the basic concept is that you just couple particles between each other, compute cross sections.
I guess conceptually, I was struggling with a notion where you can you basically have, you know, particles that interact, you know, with each other versus particles that get created and destroyed. So I'm having trouble seeing that in the Boltzmann equation.
So here the photons are, for example, for instance, for this two photon pair production, so you basically have two photons, they interact with each other. And after that, you just create pairs, which are the new sampling of the distribution function. So for Boltzmann equation, I think in terms of Boltzmann's equation, this will be some sort of an additional nonlinear source term, which couples the photon density, photon distribution with particle distribution, something like that. In our case, doing it from first principles is actually simpler because you just pretend these are real particles and compute their real cross sections, and then couple them.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, any final questions or thoughts? Okay, if not, then let's thank Heike again for this wonderful talk. And